here's our vocabulary word of the day, synecdoche. It's a figure of speech that uses a part of something to represent the whole thing. So when you talk about mouths to feed, meaning hungry people, you're using synecdoche. Or when you say nice threads to compliment someone's clothes, synecdoche. So what prompted this little vocabulary lesson? The title of the new movie that NPR's Bob Mondello is reviewing today, Synecdoche, New York.
Imagine a theater director who looks at his life as if it were a play. That's Caden, and the script of his life is, well, odd. One morning, for instance, he's attacked by his bathroom sink. The faucet works loose when he turns on the water and knocks him in the head. And after stitching him up, the emergency room, for some reason, sends him to an ophthalmologist, though he doesn't have vision problems.
Thanks for getting me in right away.
And they have this conversation.
Was it the bump to the head?
No. Could be. But I think we need to get you to a neurologist.
Neurologist?
The brain expert.
I know what a neurologist is.
Fine, I just thought from the way you asked.
I just thought you said urologist. Why do I need to see a neurologist?
It's for a look-see. The eyes are part of the brain, after all.
No, that's not true, is it?
Why would I say it if it weren't true?
Doesn't seem right.
Like morally correct or right isn't accurate?
Welcome to Caden's world, where every conversation sounds like it belongs on stage, including ones that Caden has with Hazel, a sweet box office clerk he falls for at about the same time that he wins a genius grant. The money allows him to create a massive theater piece about creating a massive theater piece. He hires Hazel as his assistant, and he hires an actor to play a stage version of himself and another to play a stage version of Hazel. And in a huge warehouse in New York City, he has his designers create a life-size New York City, and then Caden follows the actor, let's call him Caden 2, watching as Caden 2 directs Caden 1's life.
I've talked to you before. This is not a play about dating. It's about death. Make it personal. Move along.
Caden 1 kibitzes.
He doesn't need to yell at them.
And Hazel 1 takes notes.
It is a play about dating. It's not a play just about death. It's about everything. Dating, birth, death, life, family, all that.
Yeah, this doesn't look real.
What?
Actually, it looks so real, it's a little scary. The drift here is that Caden, who's played as an engagingly shambling wreck by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is a man who is constantly observing his own life rather than living it. He keeps telling Hazel, "I know how to do it now," but he never really does, so actors keep stepping out of character to comment on character, as Synecdoche, New York ties itself in intricate narrative knots. So many knots that I found myself imagining writer-director Charlie Kaufman rearranging thousands of post-it notes with plot points on them to keep it all straight. And at about that moment, the director showed Caden staring at plot point post-it notes stretching to the horizon, down the rabbit hole, through the looking glass, up the down staircase to where exactly? Well, I'm not sure I'm sure. But note that what Kaufman's having his theater-crazed character create here is more or less what a filmmaker creates every time out, a representation of reality. Caden, of course, takes the representing to a point that verges on the psychotic. Still, the way it's represented on screen is very attractive, especially considering that Synecdoche, New York marks a longtime screenwriter's directing debut. Zeppelins floating through warehouse skies, doppelgangers leaping off buildings even as technicians are putting finishing touches on the walls. I suspect viewers will find the film either intriguing or impenetrable, or perhaps both at once. But as with nearly all the films Kaufman wrote before this one, including Being John Malkovich with its portal into the title character's brain, and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind with its lovers merrily scrubbing away their memories of each other, Synecdoche, New York is quite a head trip. I'm Bob Mondello.
There are interviews with the movie's star, Philip Seymour Hoffman, and writer-director Charlie Kaufman at NPR.org. Tonight's the season finale of the TV series Mad Men. The show won the Best Drama Emmy this fall. It has a small, devoted following, including commentator Jake Halpern. After two seasons, he's finally figured out why.
My name is Jake Halpern, but it was almost Jake Hall. Back in 1957... as my uncle prepared to enter college, my grandparents called together a little family powwow in their apartment in the Bronx. My grandpa Irving expressed his concerns that the name Halpern sounded too Jewish and that my uncle might not get into the kind of private colleges that snub Jews. My father was just 12 years old at the time, but he still recalls the family gathering vividly. It was a very paranoid thing to consider doing, he later told me, but it wasn't all that crazy at the time. At the time. Sure, I knew the cold, dry history. I understood that in the late 1950s and early 1960s, Jews, women, African Americans, and gays were marginalized. By the time I was in college, in the snooty Ivy League, in the early 1990s, the straight, WASP man dressed in a Brooks Brothers shirt was practically an endangered species. Then I got hooked on the TV show Mad Men. The show brings the early 1960s to life in a way that's so fresh it almost feels like you're stepping out of a time machine. The details, right down to the women's underwear with their girdles, are meticulously recreated. And the vision is dark. For those of you who haven't seen it, the show stars Donald Draper, an ad man who works at a Madison Avenue firm, a real old boys club, a stronghold of WASPdom, a place where women typed notes, blacks worked as elevator boys, Jews begged to be taken on as clients, and gays rarely saw the light of day because they were barricaded too deep in the closet. Other artists have depicted the dark side of this era. There are some excellent books, like Revolutionary Road by Richard Yates, but nothing ever brought this period to life like Mad Men. And I'm not just talking about the anti-Semitism. I studied feminism in college, but I don't think I ever really got it until I became engrossed in the lives of the show's women, the housewives and the secretaries. Suddenly I found myself understanding why my mother was such a zealous Hillary Clinton supporter. My understanding was no longer just factual. It was visceral. In a weird way, the past wasn't real. It didn't live and breathe until I saw a fictional version of it on TV. I'm reminded of a John Kennedy quote in which he said that art establishes the basic human truth, which must serve as the touchstone of our judgment. It may be considered, well, lowbrow to call a cable TV show art, but that's precisely what it is. The writing is eloquent, the characters are nuanced, and the stories are deliciously unhurried. And ultimately, the show does what art is supposed to do. It illuminates. In my case, the changing of a name from Halpern to Hall might have made all the difference.
Jake Halpern wrote the book Fame Junkies. You can respond to his essay on the opinion section of NPR.org. Political campaigns are always trying to figure out which messages push your buttons, and now they're paying attention to the buttons on your remote control. The folks at Nielsen, the TV ratings company, just released a potentially valuable study for political advertisers. David Marins is an executive vice president with Nielsen's research group, IAG.
We usually take a look at this information based on, like, adults 18 to 49. Why don't we take a look and see if Democrats and Republicans, if their engagement with shows is different?
Their engagement. Not how many people watch a show, but who and how much they're into it. Nielsen asked self-described Democrats and Republicans how much they remembered about the shows they watched the night before. The results? Well, take Comedy Central. If you are a Republican, your engagement is much stronger with South Park.
The Founding Fathers want you all to know that we can disagree all we want, as long as we agree that America kicks ass.
Well, the Democrats prefer this.
The number one threat to America, Larry Flint, who has crossed the line with his new porn video, Who's Nailin' Palin?
That's the Colbert Report.
It won't be long before we see a porno about the Democratic candidate, Who's Riding Biden?
Okay, no real surprise there. But what about the Discovery Channel? The game show Cash Cab, where contestants win money while rolling through the streets of New York City.
Welcome to the Cash Cab. It's the only game show that takes place right here in this taxi.
And The Deadliest Catch, about the perilous work of king crab fishermen.
The fishing vessel Ocean Challenger has radioed a mayday. A Coast Guard rescue helicopter launches from Cold Bay, Alaska.
The red state Alaska versus blue state New York. Which do you think scored the highest among Democrats and Republicans?
Ironically, Deadliest Catch, which you would think might be more attractive to a Republican constituency, the Democrats. And Cash Cab, located, shall we say, in a quite urban environment, was number one on Discovery among Republicans. So maybe both sides want to pay a lot of attention to what the other world is doing.
Now, you want to know the really juicy parts of the Nielsen report? Which shows those undecided voters are watching? Well, Marin ain't talking about that. That you'll have to pay for.
You know, I'm sure that the folks who are running the McCain, Obama, and other campaigns are very interested in reaching their targets.
Sounds like Nielsen is playing the campaigns for big money.
That's right, and you just won $1,150 in the cash game.
Go to our website to see the Nielsen study and weigh in on why we watch what we watch. It's at our website, npr.org.
A serial killer, a corrupt police department, and a missing child. Clint Eastwood's new movie opening today is a true crime story based on one of the most bizarre and tragic crime stories of the 1920s. NPR's Elizabeth Blair takes a look at the real events that inspired Changeling.
It's a story with so many strange turns and outlandish characters, screenwriter Joe Straczynski didn't believe it at first. A former journalist in Los Angeles, Straczynski first heard about Christine Collins from one of his old sources at City Hall, who told him where to find more about her in the archives.
When I read over the transcript and I saw what had happened, I thought, this can't be real. This has to be a mistake.
Christine Collins, played by Angelina Jolie, was a single mom whose 9-year-old son, Walter, went missing in March of 1928. About 5 months later, a runaway from Illinois showed up, pretending to be Walter.
I live at 210 Avenue 23, Los Angeles, California. And that's my mommy.
When Christine Collins insisted the boy was not her son, Los Angeles Police Captain J.J. Jones dismissed her.
Why aren't you listening to me?
I am listening, damn it. I am listening. And I understand your feelings. He's changed, no mistake. And that's, you've both been through a terrible experience, and that's why he needs your love and support to bounce back.
He's not my son.
But Christine Collins took the boy home anyway. 3 weeks later, she returned to the LAPD to say she was absolutely certain he was not her son. The police captain accused her of shirking her duty as a mother. Joe Straczynski says he spent about a year investigating the case.
County courthouse, county library, LA Times morgue, criminal courthouse records, medical records.
Medical records, because Captain Jones was afraid Christine Collins would publicly embarrass the Los Angeles Police Department, so he had her committed to an insane asylum.
Because the police had brought back the wrong child and refused to admit that they'd made a mistake, they had to somehow say that this woman is nuts. And their best way to reinforce that was to literally incarcerate her.
The misfortunes of Christine Collins were big news in California in the late 1920s. The Los Angeles Times ran headlines like, "New kidnapping clue in hunt for missing Collins boy," "Enigma boy identified," and "Mother sues city and police for $500,000. A popular Presbyterian minister named Gustav Brigleb took up her cause. Played by John Malkovich in the movie, Brigleb's disgust with the Los Angeles Police Department was legendary.
But given its status as the most violent, corrupt, and incompetent police department this side of the Rocky Mountains, I am not sure it's saying a great deal.
When she was locked up, he was one of the foremost voices increasing her visibility to let people know what had happened.
The Reverend Brigleb's grandson, Ross, says he grew up hearing about the crusading minister who wanted to clean up L.A. But this new movie took him by surprise.
I never in my wildest dreams thought my grandfather would be portrayed in a movie, but on the other hand, he was a fairly famous guy.
Christine Collins' story is one that just when you imagine things can't get any worse, they do. Her son's body was never found, but it's almost certain that he was one of the victims in the so-called Wineville chicken murders. Gordon Stewart Northcott was convicted of killing three boys on a chicken ranch. His mother was convicted of killing Walter Collins. The brutality of the crimes created such a nightmarish image, Wineville changed its name to Mira Loma. But Joe Straczynski says he did not want the film to focus on the atrocities.
The best way and the most honorable way to tell the story was from her perspective. It really is about her war and her battle to find her son and what happened to her son.
I used to always tell him, you never start a fight, but you always finish it. And then I didn't start this fight, but I'm going to finish it.
Everyone around her had an agenda, a political agenda, personal agenda. The only clear voice in this entire story is hers.
Joe Straczynski made a name for himself in science fiction and writing comic books, including Spider-Man. He says Christine Collins is almost like a real-life superhero. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
That career as a writer of superhero stories is the topic of a lively conversation on NPR's pop culture blog. It's at npr.org/monkeysee.